call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. We have two agency presentations today and four bills on the agenda. Before we get to any of that, though, I think Representative Becker Finn is going to move the minutes for January 6, 2023. Is that correct?
That's my motion, ma'am.
Representative Becker Finn moves approval of the minutes for January 26, 2023. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We'll begin today with a presentation from the Post Board. So if you want to come on up, we've got Executive Director Eric Mislett here today. He's going to provide a brief overview of the agency. If you remember when we did the agency overviews previously, we had reserved a couple for when we were hearing bills. This is one of those overviews. So he's going to go ahead and give us a brief overview, and then we'll move to the bills on our agenda today that are related to Post Board. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eric Mislett, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, also known as POST. I'll just take a couple minutes to do a quick introduction to us, and many of you are already familiar with POST, but some of you may not be so much. We were created by legislation 1977. We replaced something called the Peace Officer Training Board, became one of the first police licensing boards in the country. Our enabling legislation, everything and all things POST, come out of 626.84 with regard to our authority and whatnot. We also are under Chapter 214. There are mandates and procedures specific to the POST board in that chapter as well. And then Chapter 6700 are our administrative rules for POST, which, as you probably are aware, we've been doing a significant rules overhaul the last couple of years. So we regulate and license and regulate the practice of law enforcement or policing in the state of Minnesota. We're under the executive branch. We have 17 members on the board. We set standards for pre-service education, continuing education, testing, licensing, and standards of conduct and licensure, which again, a lot of that was involved in the rulemaking that we've recently undergone. In terms of staff, we have about 15 positions currently, six functional divisions that deal with everything from standards compliance, where we go out to agencies and ensure they're in compliance with the standards that they have to meet, continuing education, review courses, all mandated courses and learning objectives that are mandated by the legislature, all those courses are reviewed by POST, regardless of what the source, whether it's an agency or a vendor. And then, of course, we cover pre-service education, licensing, and testing, which is done online right now through a third party, which happened in the last couple of years. And then rules coordination, as I mentioned, and then we have a data manager also on staff to help with the database, that different databases that we run in our system of record. So that is POST in a nutshell. I tried to keep it very short because I know we got a lot to talk about.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And members, my intention is for us to go ahead straight to the bills. We will have POST here available for budget presentations later. And Mr. Mislett, if you could stick around, if we get through our four bills today and then we have questions for you, maybe you could stick around and answer them at that point.
Okay.
So next on the agenda is House File 823. That is a Representative Curran bill. And Representative Curran, would you like to move your bill to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law?
Yes, I would, Chair. Thank you.
All right, wonderful. Your bill is before us, and I don't believe there are any amendments. So please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair Moeller and members. House File 823 is a pretty simple, straightforward bill. Currently, when an officer is in the background study phase of the hiring process, the employing agency conducts a background study. HF 23 mandates that criminal history check is through the BCA is part of that process. As someone who's been through that backgrounding process myself, I can assure you that that process is quite extensive. There's simply language missing that doesn't require a criminal history check through our BCA. While it could have been a simple oversight, the implications could be quite disastrous. For some context, there are several unlicensed professions in Minnesota that do require by statute a background study through the BCA. For example, direct support professionals who work with vulnerable adults and children. All background studies, in fact, required to be performed by the Department of Human Services include a clause requiring a background check through the BCA. It makes sense that our public safety system would apply the same rule. This bill also grants law enforcement agencies the ability to share such background study findings with the Post Board. This again is a simple yet important change in language that would allow the licensing agency to receive the background study data that's found by the potential employer or that law enforcement agency. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Director Misselt to offer testimony and answer questions on the bill.
Thank you. And although you just introduced yourself, because now we're moving to this bill, if you could introduce yourself again and begin your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Misselt. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Post Board. I can't really add much to what the representatives already said about the bill, other than to say the long and short of it is this bill will allow agencies to report to us when they discover a disqualifying background issue. Currently, and according to CJIS rules by the FBI and the federal government, agencies cannot share that CJIS data with licensing agencies. So this rectifies that. If they come across a disqualifier during the background check, which we cannot run, we do not run background checks, the employer does, then they are, this puts them in a place where they can share that data with us and, of course, deal with any licensing implications that has.
Thank you. Do we have any members from the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any, so we can go ahead and move to member discussion. Any discussion? Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Can I ask you how many licenses have been revoked by the Post Board in the last year?
Director Misselt.
So I would say over the last year, it's approximately, I don't know the latest count, I would say between 15 and 17, which is kind of a high year, but we had some very high-profile incidents as well within the last calendar year. Overall, going back to the origin of the Post Board, we're at about 190 or so.
Representative Whitty.
And most of those, are that because it's been reported by individuals or by the police departments that get referred back to you, or are they found on background checks?
All the above. There, we get informed of these things in a variety of ways, sometimes by the agency. Actually, with the statute that was passed in 2020, the reform statute, the chief law enforcement officer, CLEO, is required to report that to Post Board now. The majority of those, though, I will say, are based upon criminal convictions. So these are cases that have gone through the criminal courts. There's been a conviction. It falls within our jurisdiction, and then typically is an automatic revocation.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question regarding line 119. It references the fee for conducting the criminal history background check. I understand why that's not strictly defined. Fees change, but can you describe the process? Is there any predictability in what that fee will be going forward?
Representative Kern.
I would defer to Director Misselt on this one.
Director Misselt.
I'm not sure exactly what the fee is. I probably should have asked that, so I apologize for that. But I believe it's around, I want to say, $8 or $9 through the BCA. That would be taken by the applicant, yes.
Any further questions? Okay. I'm looking around to see if anybody in the audience might know the answer to that, but no one's jumping up. More member discussion? All right. Well, I'm not.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Representative Grossel.
Thank you. Oops. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking at line 2.12, and it states in there that 2.12 that local agencies are immune from civil or criminal liability.
Representative Russell, I believe you might be looking at House File 8.
Oh, which one do we have up right now?
We are on. We're on 8.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Sorry.
My apologies.
It's all right. It's confusing because they're just one apart. So right now we're on House File 823. So we'll for sure call on you when we get to 823. All right. Any further discussion on House File 823? Representative Curran, any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Chair Moeller and members, for hearing this bill today. This minor change ensures that the Post Board is licensing individuals with full criminal history information in similar fashion to other professions, and I hope you'll all join me with a yes vote.
Representative Kern renews the motion that House File 823 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Grossel, you had me now confused about what number we were on. Now we're going to move to House File 822. And
Madam Chair.
Oh, yes, Representative Novotny.
Representative Curran, was that her first bill?
Yes. I believe it was. But we have been not telling new members that they are required to bring treats. I will note, though, that my birthday is tomorrow. And if anybody wants to bring treats on Thursday for my birthday, I would be glad to celebrate with you all. So House File 822, Representative Curran, would you like to move that House File 822 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law?
Yes, Chair, that is my motion.
Wonderful. Your bill is before us, so please describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and members. Similarly to HF 823, this bill relates to data sharing between the Post Board and law enforcement agencies. It mandates that an employing law enforcement agency who is investigating an officer for misconduct shares details about the investigation with the licensing authority, which is the Post Board, as requested by the Board. Current statutes result in a lengthy, cumbersome court process that does not allow for thorough investigations nor swift action by the Board. HF 22 shows Minnesotans, including our family members in blue and tan, that the law enforcement profession is indeed one of integrity and respect. So much so that those of us who make the pledge to do this job with honor are accepting a high level of accountability that comes with a position of such power. The deaths of Tyree Nichols, George Floyd, Justine Damond, and an unfortunate number of others at the hands of those sworn to serve and protect are indeed a disgrace to the law enforcement profession. These awful incidents paint a picture of public safety that does not reflect the majority of excellent, highly trained, compassionate officers, especially here in Minnesota. Prior to my work as a deputy, I was a 911 dispatcher in White Bear Lake. And at that time, the unfortunate incident involving Justine Damon occurred when she was killed by an officer in Minneapolis after she herself had called to report an assault. I remember the overwhelming sense of sadness and disappointment among the law enforcement community. This should not have happened, and we all needed answers and justice. We also knew this tragedy and those similar create an unfortunately negative perception of what many of us know is a necessary and honorable profession. While current statutes require that law enforcement agencies submit an annual report on misconduct allegations, it does not allow the Post Board, the licensing authority itself, to run concurrent investigations alongside law enforcement agencies in real time. This missing link in the system allows for a significant delay, bringing closure to these investigations, which can leave officers waiting several months before receiving final determination of their future in the profession. It can also delay closure for victims and survivors seeking justice. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Director Missel to offer testimony and answer questions on the bill.
Please yet again introduce yourself and begin your testimony, Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric Misselt, Executive Director of the Minnesota Post Board. The main points that I want to emphasize with this piece of legislation is that this brings the Post Board up to speed with other licensing boards that have had this ability to data share with their agencies and organizations within their jurisdiction for many, many years. For whatever reason, it doesn't matter at this point, that was not part of the way statutes were set up when the Post Board was created back in 1977. So this particular piece of legislation is modeled very closely after that which is accorded to PELSBY, the Public Education Licensing Board, where school districts are not only authorized but are required to share their investigatory data with the licensing entity. So this brings us into that fold and makes it available to us so that we can do our due diligence from a licensing standpoint. The other point I would like to emphasize is that just because the Post Board, and you've heard this from me before in other cases, just because the Post Board receives either private or confidential data, or any data for that matter, the classification, the data classification does not change. So just because this is shared with the Post Board, it's not like all of a sudden we become a clearinghouse for private or confidential data. We are subject to the same rules and restrictions as the agency that holds the data or the entity that holds the data. The other point I want to add to what Representative Curran said is that one of the other part of the other reason for having this statute is the fact that when we cannot get this data, we're not only do we have to issue subpoenas and then ultimately court orders, but if we have to do the whole investigation from start to finish all over again, we are re-interviewing witnesses, we are re-interviewing potential victims, the officer or the accused themselves is hanging out there for months waiting to wonder what's going to happen, because in most cases any agency discipline has already been completed and handed down. And so typically whatever it is done, but now they have to wait for additional time to hear what the licensing board might do to their license. So from many different aspects, it's much more efficient, streamlined, doesn't keep people waiting. We don't have to rehash, re-interview people and do that sort of thing. So there's a lot of good reasons for that. The other thing I will mention too, just one more, I'm sorry, with regard to confidential versus private data. This does include confidential data. Few and far between are going to be the cases where we're actually getting or needing confidential data. Most of it's going to be private. But the reason that is included in there is because there are cases where we may be doing an inquiry and the subject of that inquiry should not know for investigative purposes that there in fact is an investigation and some data being exchanged with the Post Board, because it could jeopardize that investigation. So with that, thank you.
Thank you. And we did have one person sign up to testify, Richard Neumeister. Welcome. Come on back, Mr. Neumeister. Introduce yourself.
Chair Mueller, my name is Rich Neumeister. It's always a pleasure to come to the Public Safety or Civil Law Committees historically over the years. It's very simple, very straight. Let's go to page 1, lines 18. And I spoke with the executive director of the Post Board, Madam Chair, and he already knew what my comment as a courtesy. But confidential data, usually in the law enforcement dynamic, is an active criminal investigation. So, as you know, the jurisdictions of both civil law and public safety sometimes come over. So I sort of say, well, what is the kind of data that they want? And from my angle, that's an issue, because usually confidential means you get nothing. Usually, and with the licensing schemes that the Post Board Executive Director referred to, I don't see where confidential private and public information is shared in investigations. It's usually public and private data. Again, the term confidential. So now, who would this be on? This would be on the individual officer. Officers have due process rights, just like teachers do, just like over the years I've put my two cents in, even though I'm not a teacher or a police officer, because I know how data can hurt people sometimes. So if you're going to proceed on this kind of thing, I think it's important that there be some kind of notice mechanism. I have concerns about where confidential information is being shared about a subject, and then that some kind of decision may happen based on that confidential data, and that individual may never have access to that data if it retains that confidential. So for your jurisdiction, I think you should, one, get notice. Should the post board have access to confidential information? Madam Chair, those are my comments.
Thank you for your testimony. And this, the motion before us is to refer this to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. So that sounds like a perfect discussion. Not that we can't discuss that here, but one that we'll also be having in the Judiciary Committee. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? All right, I'm not seeing anybody else, so we'll move to member discussion. And Representative Grossel, is this the time now where you'd like to ask your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, usually when I'm looking at numbers, 22 comes before 23, and it just caught me off guard there just for a moment. But thank you. So I just looking at line 2.12, where it says that local agencies are immune from civil or criminal liability for reporting not public data. Should the or not be an and?
Representative Curran or Director Mislett? Just to clarify, Representative Grossel,
yes.
You're saying the or on line 2.12. You're wondering if that should be an and.
Yeah.
Director Mislett?
I guess I'll have to beg ignorance on that one. I'm not a lawyer. I did run this by the AG's office, but that may be something we over an oversight. So open to advice.
I can.
Yeah, Mr. Debo.
Madam Chair and members, I think it works either way, but you could substitute and to cover both grounds. Or I don't know if the result would be different. You had the word conjunction.
Yeah, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just note, I could imagine an argument if it's the and, that these people are immune from civil and criminal liability somehow if they're combined. But I mean, the purpose of the or is to say they're immune from civil liability, they're immune from criminal liability, and if there's some way to combine the two, I don't know what it would be, but whatever that is. So no, I think the or is correct. Would be my opinion, Representative Grossel.
Representative Grossel, any follow-up?
Just looking at it, we just want to make sure that it's clear.
Yep.
And to remove that, both of those civil and, I think would make it a little more clear.
Thank you.
But you've been here a lot longer than I have, Mr. Diebel. So.
Oh, Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, members, I'm not a it practice expert, but in that statute or that chapter of law, chapter 13, the civil remedies and the criminal remedies are in separate statutes. And so there are remedies for someone who's aggrieved by a government not handling the data properly to pursue action against the government actor. And there's also an option for a prosecutor to criminally charge a government actor who is violates the law.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Who gets this information? Is it board staff, or does it go to the board of directors that can see the complaints that come in?
Director Mislett.
So the data, while the investigation's ongoing, goes to our board staff, who deal with this kind of data all the time. They package it up, and then it first goes to the Complaint Investigation Committee of the board, subcommittee of the board, and we run through a process there before The only time it would ultimately go to the full board is when there is final discipline being proposed and it requires the full board's approval.
Representative Woody.
Thank you. Obviously, I appreciate your comments, Representative Curran, on when officers tarnish the badge and hold them accountable. But what I would be concerned about, and I think you just answered the question for me, is a leak that would then kind of compromise an investigation also. So that's why I was wondering, and also that we are protecting the officer's rights through the process until the very end. So thank you on that.
Representative Curran, did you have a comment to that?
Yes, I appreciate your perspective on that. I really do. But I think it's important to step back and, if we're questioning the integrity of the post board, to me, that's also questioning the authority and the licensing process overall that they have over peace officers. So I would hesitate to have, any sort of reservations about the integrity of their processes.
All right. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Curran, thank you for bringing this bill, and Director Missel, thank you for testifying and providing some clarity on some of the details, particularly the confidentiality will remain what the data is transferred. This is important. Since I joined the legislature, as many folks know, I'm a labor attorney and I work a lot in the education area, and so I interact with Pelsby quite often, and I understand how that works. And it has always been kind of mystifying to me that the post board has not had the same ability to collect information when they are doing their investigations, and particularly for the service and the work that our law enforcement does and the power, discretion, and ability that they have when they interact with our community members. I think this will go a long ways in addressing some of the mistrust that we have in communities in terms of providing some transparency, but most importantly, some efficiency around when you're doing the investigations. It's nothing more important than when an issue or misconduct happens and those allegations are out there that we investigate thoroughly, but also efficiently and swiftly, so we can provide information and closure to community members around those particular issues. So thank you for bringing this.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the language in line 111, stating that an agency will respond to any data request from the board, period. But then below, there's language in lines 114 and 115 that provide more specificity, saying that the language shall be provided to the board with all requested public and private data about alleged misconduct involving a licensed peace officer. My question is the intention here to limit data shared or that must be shared to that which is relevant to an alleged incident of misconduct?
Director Mislett.
Yes, that is correct. This isn't designed to be able to go on fishing expeditions. I've got plenty to do without doing that, aside from the issues of whether that's wrong or right in the first place. But this is very specific. It's only when we've ordered an investigation, and we believe that it falls within our jurisdiction. That's correct.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
Thank you, Chairman Wick. Director Missel, prices this investigative board?
Director Missel.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The question was, who is on the investigative board?
For the criminal complaint investigation committee?
That's
Representative Novotny.
Yes, I'm sorry. Looking for who would be having access to this private data.
Director Missel.
So the complaint investigation committee is currently composed of four members. Four of those are either current or former law enforcement officers, and then one public member of the board.
Representative Botney.
Thank you, Chair. And Director Missel, so do we have the same data practices that are going to be required of this data to be stored? Are they getting the yearly training, the certification for making sure that they're maintaining the data securely and that the safeties are in place?
Director Missley.
So staff are regularly. We go through the training, data practices training every year. Board members typically do not. However, they are well aware of what they can and cannot share. Additionally, there are two attorneys that represent the board. One represents the Complaint Investigation Committee specifically. The other one represents the board at large. And the Complaint Investigation Committee attorney is there for all proceedings and basically ensures that all legal aspects are followed. My experience with the board and the Complaint Investigation Committee specifically, as I mentioned early on, is that we are bound by the same statutes as anybody else. If it's private data, it's handled a certain way. We maintain we have a secured file location, obviously, internally. And then anything that would be shared with the Complaint Investigation Committee members is either via paper when they come in or through a secured SFTP site.
Representative Navafi.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And just I'd just like to clarify, we're here to ask questions. We're not necessarily questioning anyone's integrity when we just want to make sure what a particular bill means or what it involves or getting details that's not included in testimony. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm just trying to, I've got my public safety brain on now, not my civil law judiciary brain on, but I do think there is a penalty if somebody discloses information that's supposed to be private. I believe there's actually a criminal penalty in Chapter 13 for that that I think would apply here. So that maybe is something we can get into more when this goes to judiciary. But I am recalling a provision in Chapter 13 that does account for that as well. Any further member questions or discussion? Representative Curran, closing comments.
Yes, thank you, Chair Mueller and members, for hearing this bill today. I really appreciate the discussion on this. Becoming a licensed peace officer was one of the greatest joys and achievements of my life. Police officers in Minnesota hold a license of peacekeeping. It's in the name itself, licensed peace officer. Unfortunately, our state's current laws are not in alignment with the spirit of our commitment to peacekeeping. HF 822 brings us to the level needed to ensure swift and just application of measures to rid our public safety system of the bad actors who tarnish the wonderful, courageous, and often thankless work performed by those who've earned their badge. I believe accountability brings greater pride in your work. Minnesota is known nationally for having high standards for officers. We should be proud of that, and I'm sure most, if not all of us in this committee, are proud of that. This bill doubles down on the confidence that we have in the majority of Minnesota's peace officers who sacrifice so much for our daily peace and our safety. I thank my colleagues for consideration and encourage a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 822 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Director. Thank you, Representative Curran. The next bill we have on our agenda is, before we get to that, actually we have another presentation from the Minnesota Office of the Ombuds for Corrections. So welcome to the committee. We've got Margaret Zadra, the ombudsperson, and if you could go ahead and provide us with an overview before we get to the bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Mueller and committee members and Representative Tapke. Grateful that you're carrying this. My name is Margaret Zadra, and I am the ombudsperson for corrections. And like I said, I'm really grateful to be here today to talk about the Office of the Ombuds for Corrections. As many of you know, due to the diligence and bipartisan work from so many of you and so many community members, the Office of the Ombuds for Corrections was newly recreated in the 2019 legislative session and then was able to be set up and start taking complaints in 2020. The office is completely separate and independent from the Department of Corrections, and our statutory mission is to promote the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. Part of how we do that is that we can receive, investigate, and resolve complaints and provide an impartial and unbiased process for incarcerated individuals, corrections staff, and community members to share their concerns about corrections agencies' actions and policies. We have unique and critical access to data and information that is typically not available to the public, and we can provide an independent and impartial review of issues and concerns. Over the past biennium, we have received almost 1,000 general complaints, and in addition, several thousand more COVID-specific complaints during the height of the pandemic directly related to COVID processes. For about two-thirds of all of our general complaints that we receive, we're able to resolve them quickly with early resolution, meaning we're able to provide either information or referrals or connect with agency staff and resolve issues quickly. The rest of those require a more in-depth investigation, which sometimes can take a couple of days or many, many months. This past year, we've had fewer complaints in general, in part due to some of the efforts related to education and processes. However, many of the complaints are more complex and often require additional consultation, collaboration, or investigation within facilities. Additionally, investigators from our office and myself regularly visit facilities and provide additional opportunities for less formal interactions with both corrections staff and incarcerated people to share their concerns with us and to observe policies and processes in action. We also provide education and information to help people navigate a really difficult system. And this year, we embarked on a collaborative pilot project with the DOC to provide additional information for families and look forward to sharing a report with all of you on that soon. We can republish reports and make recommendations to the Department of Corrections, the legislature, and the governor. And in this way, we can take issues that may be brought forth by one or two or a handful of people and make recommendations that make the process overall more just and more efficient for everybody. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on the overview piece, so that's kind of concludes that. But I do want to explain that part of why the bill before you came about is that as we were looking at those best practices across the board, we were also looking at our own enabling statute and realized it could use some tightening up. So do you want to?
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much. And again, we'll have you back when we're doing presentations too for questions, but we are running ahead of schedule, so members have just general questions about your agency or your office. If you can stick around, Ombuds, Zadra, and we can get those questions answered after we've gone through the bills. So next up, we have House File 745. Representative Tabke, would you like to move that House File 745 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
So move, Madam Chair.
All right, your bill is before us. If you could go ahead, please, and describe your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Today we have a really simple but very important bill that we are going through with House File 745 here. I have a corrections facility in my district and represent the incarcerated individuals there, and it's really important that people, when they have issues and concerns, that they have an independent and separate place to voice those concerns and to have someone advocating on their behalf as folks who are dependent upon the state for everything they've got going on. So what we have here is in lines 1-9 and 1-10. It removes the serve of the pleasure of the governor and adds be appointed by the governor and makes it so it's a just cause employee. So there's no reason that politics can get involved in this position and make sure that it is separate and independent as it moves forward.
Thank you. And I believe the Ombuds Zadra is going to testify about the need for this as well. So please introduce yourself yet again, and you can begin your testimony.
Margaret Zadra, Ombuds for Corrections. So as mentioned, this was really about tightening up that statute. And the possibility of removal from office and retribution for carrying out an unpopular investigation or making a critical report or for political reasons can be a real or indirect threat to the independence of the office. The United States Ombuds Association standards, as well as the International Venice Principles, include removal only for just cause for ombuds people. You'll find in your materials today also a letter of support from the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I don't want to spend a ton of time on my testimony, but this does put us in line with other ombuds offices in Minnesota, and I think it helps reinforce that independence and an appearance of independence as well.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify? Okay, Mr. Neumeister, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. 1973 is when the Ombudsman Office was
done. Theatrice Williams was the first ombudsperson. I started interacting with the ombudsman's office when they were coming to the legislature, doing their presentations and asking for certain kinds of law changes, particularly with data practices. But other than, I used to be a former probation officer in the late 70s. So I became aware of the ombuds office. I worked a lot with John Pupar, who then was the second ombudsman appointed after T. Williams left. The thing is, this is an important office. They were always generally, and I've talked with a lot of the ombuds people, well, Rich, you know, we go down this way or that way, you know, to be unpopular. But these were strong people, and they still did their way. This language protects. They don't have, you know, they don't have to worry. And that's an important thing. In 2003, this was abolished by the legislature, a strong community group. And I was one of those folks. We held some groups. There was even a legislature appointed a group, a work group, to come up with recommendations. But the institutions like sheriffs and all that said, well, we don't need an ombudsperson. And then a lot of community groups said, we needed one. And then 2018, 17, Mr. Considine and someone on the Republican side said, let's do it. And they brought it back. This is a continuation of that positive step to having a good, independent person who can go into some of these places and hear about what's happening in prisons. Madam Chair, much obliged to you for your time. This is good stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Anybody else from the public wishing to testify? All right, we'll move to member discussion, but before we do, I do see that we have an amendment. We have the A1. Representative Novotny, are you offering the A1 amendment?
I am, Chair.
Please describe your amendment to us.
My amendment simply adds Senate oversight and adds the Senate confirmation hearing before we're doing a lifetime appointment to a person. You know, keep in mind, no one else in the state has a lifetime appointment. Our state Supreme Court even has to go up for elections. So this is right now no accountability to the legislature. All the cabinet commission, all of the commissioners appointed by governor are go before the Senate committee, and I just think a position as important as this should get a little oversight and should have a little legislative input before confirmation to a lifetime position, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Representative Tapke to the A1.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Lead Novotny. Thank you for the amendment. I am going to ask that people vote down the amendment today because there are no other ombuds that are required to go through Senate confirmation, so this would separate it from how other ombuds for the state of Minnesota are handled, as well as it would, and the reason for that is it would very much eliminate the ability to be separate and independent of political whims of other things that are going on throughout the state. So I recommend a no vote on this amendment, please.
Discussion to the amendment. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And, you know, the point of the bill is to make it so that political reasons can't stop the ombudsperson from doing their work. And I think, unfortunately, as we've seen in the last 4 years, Senate confirmation has become very political, which I think undermines what we're trying to accomplish with the bill. So would also urge a no vote on this amendment. Thank you.
Further discussion. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Tapke, for bringing this bill. I'm trying to understand. I heard Representative Novotny mention lifetime appointment, and I don't – is there a lifetime appointment in this bill?
Representative
Tapke. The changes that we're working on today does not have anything to do with lifetime appointment, no.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do see the Just Cause Standard, and as a labor guy, and as someone that is a member of a union with Just Cause Standard, and as so law enforcement in their union contracts, they have Just Cause Standard. This is something that protects the individual and employee, and so I support those protections, and it does remove them from the political whims and political issues that we are absolutely facing in these polarizing times. So I would urge a no vote as well.
Further discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to save this for the underlying bill, but it's become relevant to the discussion regarding this amendment. And part of it is probably might just be my personal education, but when it comes to the just cause standard, somebody has to determine whether or not, I mean, it's described here in this document we have from the ombuds regarding that references the statute that establishes enacts the office, that the person shall be highly competent and qualified to analyze questions of law, administration, public policy. There's another document we've been provided with that outlines the complaint process and various requirements. Somebody needs to determine whether or not those things are being met. If it's not the governor and it's not the legislature, who is it? What do we do when there is, in fact, a just cause?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Hudson, that's a very good question. So this just cause does not eliminate the does not remove the ability to let a person go if they are not doing their job. There has to be cause for that elimination. And so what this is it's still the governor's office that is allowed to determine that just cause. And so it will happen through that avenue. Exactly what that is for this specific position through the governor's office, I'm not entirely sure, but the governor's office is in charge of making sure if someone is not doing their job that they are removed from that office.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So by adding just cause, you're insulating the ombuds to some degree from just political whim, but wouldn't adding a confirmation from the Senate dilute the governor's ability to whimsically pursue accusations of just cause?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, I do not agree with that, no.
And I do see that Ombud Sadra came back down, and if you could address the question as well about just cause, please.
Right, so thank you, Chair and Representative. So. Right. To reinforce what Representative Tabby Kent said, it would still be up to the governor's office, and then there would just be it's almost like a guide, right? Instead of it being for removal because they feel like it, then it's a guide that this is a standard for removal. If somebody felt that they were removed without cause, then they would have recourse through the Attorney General's office or even some other way. But this is really still the standard that's already set up in the statute for ensuring competent nonpartisan, all of those things, and it is then a guide for how it moves forward.
Representative Hudson, anything further?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, in regards to this particular amendment, I don't see how adding Senate confirmation to the process would do anything but further the goal of the state of legislation, which is to ensure that deliberation and consideration is injected into the process of determining whether or not the ombud is doing the job properly. I would recommend a yes vote.
Thank you. Further member discussion to the amendment? Any closing remarks on your amendment, Representative Novotny?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. We don't want it to be a political appointment, but it's an appointment from a politically elected person any more than the Supreme Court positions are appointed by the politically appointed person. I recommend a yes vote.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
The A1 amendment is not adopted. All right, so now we can move on to further discussion of the bill. Do we have any other comments or questions about the bill? I know we kind of got into that with the amendment a little bit too. All right, I'm not seeing anything. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Just one quick question for you, Representative Tapke. So under 43A.33 subdivision 2, it lists the definitions of what constitutes just cause, with one being substandard performance. I'm just curious as to if that could be somewhat subjective in its use for the potential removal of an ombudsperson.
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Engen, thank you for that question. Yeah, anything could be subject to opinions, anything could be subject to that, but as Ms. Zadra said, if it is, by having the just cause status in here, it is able to, there's recourse for the person if they were to be let go. And so that very much clarifies what the intent is of the position and to remove it from politics.
Any further follow-up? Representative? No? All right, closing comments, Representative Tappy.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. And so as I said in my introduction, I represent the Women's Correction Facility in Shakopee, and this bill bringing back the ombudsperson came back through while I was on the Corrections Committee in 2019 and 2020, and we heard a lot of, I get a significant amount of correspondence from folks who are incarcerated there just on different issues that are going on, and it's really important that we have this position that is able to handle and go through issues as they come up in an independent and separate way from the politics and from the government going on. So thank you very much, everyone. I encourage a yes vote on this bill.
Representative Tappy renews the motion that House File 745 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Tappy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And oh, just in time, Representative Erdahl, just walking in right as we were going to bring your bill before us. So the next bill on our agenda is House File 357. We will be laying over this bill, so I will move, though, that the bill is before us. Welcome to our committee, Representative Erdahl. And I do believe that you have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And it looks like the A1 amendment just puts the bill in the shape the author desires. So I will move the A1 amendment. Do you have anything to say specifically about the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, it just makes the bill consistent in the verbiage as probationary. Probationary is used twice, and then they use another word at the end. It's just a consistency thing.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Now to your bill as amended, Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Always, I was going to say, always good to be in front of you. I think I've only done it one other time, and that was with this bill last year, which was included in Representative Mariani's bill, but we all know what kind of happened at the end of the last session to almost every bill. So this should have happened last year. So in an explanation here, there is a compact that the state of Minnesota has. There is a mandate on the transfer of adult offenders in interstate commerce, for which there's a mandate on sheriffs and counties with no funding. And I'd like to comment just a little bit here, reading some comments from the Meeker County Sheriff, Brian Cruz. I will also say that this bill has the support of the Minnesota Sheriffs Association. What happens when an offender on probation in Minnesota moves to another state, then violates his probation, is that a warrant is issued, and per the compact, he must be returned to the originating state. In all of the documentation I've read, that's from the sheriff, it refers to the state as the responsible party. There is no mention of the county or sheriff anywhere. He says also, we have seen a shift in the courts where not many people are held on bail, so there's a very high likelihood we will spend significant resources to get a person to only have them get out of jail as soon as they make their first court appearance. To put this in context, I had a guy in Kentucky on an outstanding warrant for a criminal sex charge. It cost us nearly $3,000 to get him. He went to court, got a low bail, and the court allowed him to return to Kentucky the next day. So the state really needs to have a fund so that sheriffs and counties can be reimbursed for these expenses. The local sheriffs met with the DOC to work this out, and this bill is the result. With that, I do have a testifier, and that is the Commissioner of DOC, Commissioner Schnell.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Schnell. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
to speak in support of this bill. I am Paul Schnell, the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, and as I said, we are here to express support for this, for House File 357, and I'd like to extend our thanks to Representative Erdahl for carrying this bill. We did speak in support of this last year. The issue is important for the sheriff's budgets across the state. The Department of Corrections has been regularly engaged in conversations with the Sheriff's Association and sheriffs for the past several years about the need for a mechanism to fund the transport of people subject to the Interstate Compact for Adult Supervision and bring those individuals back to Minnesota in accordance with the compact. The Interstate Compact for Adult Supervision provides for uniform guidelines to regulate the movement of probationers and supervised releasees across state lines. The compact is enacted in all 50 states promotes effective supervision strategies that are consistent with public safety and victim rights. To provide some context, in 2018, there were nearly 3,000 people with criminal sentences that originated in Minnesota but had their supervision transferred to another state in accordance with the compact. When a person under supervision absconds or convicted of a new felony crime under the Interstate Compact, a nationwide warrant is issued, and that person is required to be returned to the state where the sentence originated. The cost, responsibility for transporting individuals on supervised release to bring them back to Minnesota is borne by the Department of Corrections, and we have a transport staff that does that. The cost and responsibility for transporting a person on probation at the county level back to Minnesota is assumed by the county which the person was sentenced and placed under probation supervision. And that transportation must occur regardless of how far or how expensive it is to provide that transport. This request will help counties, particularly those counties with small budgets, comply with federal rules. In turn, nationwide arrest warrants will be issued in a timely manner, and the subjects of those warrants are returned to Minnesota. Should this pass, the DOC would monitor and track the number of nationwide warrants issued, the number of individuals transported back to Minnesota, and the costs required to provide those transports. Madam Chair, members, I want to just make you aware that due to an oversight on our part, this item was not included in the governor's budget. But we stand in wholesale support of this measure, and I would stand for any questions that you may have. And I thank you, Madam Chair, members, for the opportunity to speak in support of this.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Erdahl, do you have any other testifiers?
No, I don't.
All right, thank you. Anyone from the public wishing to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing anyone, so we can go ahead and move to member discussion. Any questions? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Representative Erdahl, Commissioner Snell, what happens if the appropriation is used up in a particular year?
Commissioner Snell.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, that has been a subject of ongoing conversation. One of the things that we need to do is really get a clear understanding of the amount of the number of these transports. We do believe that this $250,000 appropriation annually would be used up rather quickly, given some of the costs that can be incurred in these transports. But I think it's really important that we have that data. Right now, we have that data for supervised releasees, but since these warrants are issued by county courts, not by the Department of Corrections, it's a bit harder to track the totality of those costs. So that's something that this is a starting appropriation, and what we've committed with the Sheriff's Association, with the sheriffs, is that we would work with them, see how far this goes, and then ultimately look at future changes to that appropriation going forward.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And either testifier, looking through this, and I'm concerned because naturally I just went through the county attorney's bill, actually the AG bill, to help the county's attorneys, and counties are definitely in trouble because I looked at this as the legal side, and I also looked at the EMS side. Do we have any kind of idea how much counties are paying for this in whole? I mean, a general idea?
Commissioner Schnapp.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, we do have a sense. I mean, I think the anecdote that was provided by Representative Rudall, I've talked personally to a number of sheriffs across the state who are, you know, some cases they may not even have the staffing, and in those cases they are contracting for these services with private transport organizations, and that comes at a considerable cost. You know, it can be $3,000-$4,000 to bring somebody back from California, as a for instance, that it can also take some considerable time. So, you know, so this is really an important issue. We have tried to collaborate as much as we can with the sheriffs. In some instances, we've been fortunate enough to package some of our transports that we had for supervised releases and work collaboratively with the sheriffs to bring somebody back when we were providing a transport nearby. But that is not always the case. And so in those instances, it's really important that they have access to these resources. We believe that this is and I believe the Sheriff's Association has taken this position, that this amount is a great way to start this, initiate this process, and really learn over the next biennium what the need actually is.
Representative Hewitt.
Real quick, Madam Chair, more of a statement, but I do see this as a needed service. I see that this is another area, similar to the AG's bill, that the state has to step in and help with these situations, and I appreciate you bringing the bill, Mr. Dr. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And just briefly, Representative Erdahl, I wanted to echo Representative Hewitt in thanking you for bringing this bill forward. In many different areas here, we've heard the burden that counties often have with costs. So I appreciate bringing the state in to help alleviate those costs and, as a result, increase safety measures in Minnesota. So thank you.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Schnell, what does it cost the DOC per year to do this very same thing, to get these people back to Minnesota?
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, I don't have the exact amount. You know, we have a transportation unit. Sometimes they're providing those, you know, they may drive out to pick somebody up depending upon how far. Sometimes they fly out to bring them back. I can get that information to you, but you know, there is considerable expense in returning these people safely back to Minnesota in these cases.
Representative Grossel.
Because I mean, you said it yourself that the amount that's in appropriated here would be used up very quickly. Would it be better to get that number and then maybe add that to put this in here to make it something that we're not gonna hit the ground running and flop on our face? But at least hit the ground running and be able to have a better, more resources to work with and to find out where we need to be.
Commissioner Schnapp.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, I think, you know, we have had these conversations with the Sheriff's Association, and while those resources are really critical, we know, to the counties, the sense was that this was a good place to start. We are also, as an agency, committed to always working with the sheriffs to find ways to problem solve these issues. We want to make sure that where people need to be held accountable, brought back to our state because of a violation of the terms and conditions of their probation or supervised release, they do it. I would just argue that there is a difference between probation and supervised release, and that it's difficult to apply one to the other.
Representative
Russell. I would like to have those numbers if you'd be so kind, sir.
Absolutely. Okay.
Commissioner Schnell, if you would share those with our committee administrator so we'll make those available to all the committee members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll do that.
Any further discussion? Closing comments, Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank the committee. You know, this is an important bill. It's very important to our counties and our sheriffs, particularly in greater Minnesota, our smaller counties. The amount, $250,000, as the commissioner said, a starting point. You know, hopefully, if they were to run a little short, the commission would be able to come up with a little bit more money for it. But in any event, this gets us going and would be able to establish maybe another number in the future. But I thank you for this and for your appreciation and support, and you know, I only bring good bills, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here. So I'll renew my motion and lay over House File 357 as amended. Now, that is the last bill on the agenda, and as I mentioned, we'd ask Director Mislett and
Ombuds Zadra to stick around in case we had time left and anybody had any questions for either of them. Oh, all right. Do we have Representative Hudson?
Yeah, sure, Madam Chair. Given the opportunity, I'd love to hear from the ombuds regarding just like the general category of complaints, kind of a sense of the state of corrections and what potential issues we might want to dive into at some point.
Okay, thank you. And did you hear that? Okay, so sorry. I knew you were walking down, and sometimes the mics are harder to pick up. So Representative Hudson, would you repeat your question?
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm interested in kind of your general sense of the state of things at DOC and the types of complaints that you're receiving and the work that you're doing and what it highlights in terms of potential areas that we could work on in the future here at the legislature.
And Ombuds Zadra, because we're out of order, just introduce yourself one more time before you answer that question.
Sure. Thank you. Margaret Zadra, Ombudsperson for Corrections. Thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Hudson. So I will say that one of the things that is most concerning and challenging is the under-resourcing. And so oftentimes what we're seeing is that staff are often wearing multiple hats and doing so in really smart, creative ways, but working in situations that aren't ideal. So I'm sure you will hear this in, if you're on bonding committee or hear any of those, but overall, you know, we have facilities that are quite old and haven't been properly resourced, and so staff are often tasked with coming up with creative ways to address those issues in front of them. And even though they're being really creative about it, I have concerns about safety for both staff and incarcerated people in facilities that we would not approve for other purposes, because we really are looking at buildings that have seen better days. So that's one thing. I'm also concerned about the resources that local facilities are accessing, and part because over and over again we are seeing situations where, again, staff may be coming up with really thoughtful, creative ways to address the situations in front of them, but they are working with people who prison is not likely the best place for them. That's not in our jurisdiction to make those decisions. That's up to the courts. And but often, you know, people are being held in local facilities for quite a long time, pre-trial, and may have really significant substance use or mental health needs, particularly with youth. We're seeing that, right, where a juvenile detention might not be the best place for them, and staff might be really working hard to come up with creative ways to help address their concerns and issues, but it's just not the best place for them. And so over and over again, they'll be filing complaints either with our office or with other folks, and we look at it and we say, you know, there's not anything that staff is doing wrong. They're not violating a rule. There's not, but this likely isn't the best place for this individual. And again, that's not our purview, but if there was additional resources for those local facilities or additional places, and I know these are ongoing conversations that you all are having as well, to address some of these issues, that would be a huge benefit to both the facilities and the people that are working there and the people that are housed there. Does that help answer? I can dig deep a little bit more on specific types of complaints we receive, but overall, those are my biggest concerns.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, that's a very good overview. I thank you for that. I could just Google it, but since I've got you here, are there ways that we can access information that comes out of your complaints so that we can do that deeper dive out of here?
Sure.
Ombuds Zadra.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So we do have an annual report. I do not have a 2022's out yet. That should be out shortly. And I'd be happy to meet with you after this as well, but you can look at our previous annual reports, and we do actually catalog, you know, the subject complaint subjects that we receive, so you can look and see, oh, they received, you know, this many complaints related to food or related to health services or related to, you know, the treatment by staff. So that we do separate that out and make sure we're not sharing any private or confidential details, but overall give a view of what our office does and what we hear.
Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious about timelines. So, whoa, my microphone doesn't want to be here. Just timelines for when families reach out to your office and express concerns about lack of religious activities or recreational activities or access to family members and don't really feel heard, at least from what I've heard. I'm just curious about timelines for your providing information and recommendations. And if you have any thoughts on that timeline and what we can do to make sure that people feel heard. Thank you.
Ombud Sadra.
Thank you, Chair Representative. So typically anything that comes into our office, we like to have some kind of response within a couple of days. And so often if a family is calling, we're calling them back that same day and addressing process issues right away. If somebody has not heard back from us, it's likely we didn't actually receive the complaint. We have had some issues where people have sent, you know, complaints to other ombuds offices, and it takes a little while to get over to us and forwarded on, and vice versa, right? Somewhat regularly, we're able to needing to forward on to other ombuds offices. So if somebody's not hearing back from us, that's concerning, and it's likely that we didn't actually receive that. I do think sometimes it's frustrating that, you know, sometimes families get frustrated because it's, we're not able to give them the answer that they want. And that's a, it's a real frustration. They, you know, are wanting to visit with their loved one more, and their visiting hours might be delayed or, you know, smaller because of COVID transmission, or, you know, there might be some other issue happening. And oftentimes, you know, once we kind of explain the process and also explain how their loved one can file a complaint on their own behalf, we do say, you know, the information that you give to us, we're looking at that overall as well. And so we don't necessarily then follow back up with that every single person who says, I have concerns about visitation, when we have a bigger, broader, you know, conversation with the DOC about visitation, right? But in general, we are responding within a couple of days. And if we have accepted it for an investigation, we like to close those out within, you know, a month and a half or so. And the reality is depending on how complex it is, it might go a lot longer, and then we're trying to make sure we're giving updates to people.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Does it ever go the other way? Does do you ever get complaints from staff on the conditions in there, like a whistleblower type?
Ombud Sadra.
Thank you. So, yes, we do take staff complaints. Our purview for staff complaints is pretty narrow. It has to be unique to corrections. And they, just like we ask incarcerated people, we ask staff to follow the administrative process. So any internal process that's available to them, we ask them to follow that first, because it's important to have a working, a system that works well for them to address their complaints. But yes, we do hear from staff both about things that they have related to their work, but also things that they want to see improved, because I will say that oftentimes some of their concerns are, you know, they're experts at it, right? Like, they're working there every day. And so often staff share, like, hey, I wish we could do this better. And, you know, then we talk about how they can either reach out to administration and how to share those ideas, or we take them in and look at them as well. But, yes, we do hear from staff pretty regularly.
Thank you. Obviously, that there's a relationship there, too, knowing quite a few correction officers probably working at the Twins. They talk about those relationships, and that's helping each other out. I guess, do you feel like when you're getting the questions or the complaints and you're bringing them forward, you think they're being heard, and are the adjustments being made at the upper levels that you need help at?
Thank you. Yes. I do think that we're grateful to have a good working relationship both with each facility's leadership and overall leadership. I think, you know, sometimes we make recommendations and we're told no. That's a real thing, because our power isn't we're not enforcers. We can make recommendations, but oftentimes there is interest in figuring out best practices and better practices and moving forward, and particularly reviewing and looking at policies that might need some updating, right? Like, that's a regular conversation.
Anything further, Representative Whitty? All right, I'm not seeing anyone else raising their hands. Thank you so much for coming down. Thanks for the great questions from our members. Appreciate that. And members, that's it for today. We do have four bills on the agenda for Thursday. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.